debt, dominance, and the U.S. dollar. From SDPB, today is Wednesday, May 21st. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, macroeconomist Joe Santos is here to explain the dance between the budget deficit and the trade deficit. We sail through the latest crash course in the macroeconomy as it unfolds around us. That's coming a bit later in the hour. Dakota political junkies John Hunter and Mike Card offer analysis on ICE arrests in Madison and how a city is impacted by the removal of 8 community members. But first, SDPB's Lee Strubinger connects the dots between South Dakota's incarceration practices and a new report that predicts the future cost of state corrections. That's coming up after the news. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're In the Moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. A new report says South Dakota needs to build a new 1,500-bed men's prison and then get ready for the next new facility. SDPB's Lee Strubinger has been following the story. He joins us with insights from the latest report, the Project Prison Reset Task Force, and the costs of incarceration in South Dakota. He's seated in SDPB's Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City. Lee Strubinger, welcome back.
Good to be here, Lori.
I saw this story come out over the weekend and got to spend some time with it this weekend. So first of all, thank you for that. Thank you for ruining my weekend. No. thank you for the update. This is an ongoing thing. Tell me about this particular report.
So casual observers might be like, wait, wasn't there a report? What's this new report, et cetera? Yeah. So this is basically a report that dusts off a report from 2021,
okay,
which has kind of really sort of guided this discussion about building a new men's prison. It's what led lawmakers to establish the Incarceration Construction Fund that they've been putting money into in order to fund building a new men's prison, because the current one is 144 years old. So this isn't a brand new report, but it does take a look at some sort of maybe changes that have occurred since 2021. Yeah. And is almost another second opinion, because there was a little bit of a second guessing by lawmakers about whether or not a 1,500-bed men's prison was the correct way to go.
Right.
This report basically says, yeah, you need to do it.
And you need to maybe do more. Tell me about some of the key findings from it.
Yeah, so again, the key finding that folks were really looking for was, is the idea of constructing a 1,500-bed men's prison the correct course of action? This report reaffirmed that. I think what has really shocked a lot of people and has been Lieutenant Governor Tony Van Huysen called a reality check, mm-hmm, which is that if the state's charging landscape, the amount of felonies and stuff that are on the books in state law, if that remains, given the current trajectory, the state's prison population is going to increase by another 30% in the next 10 years. And part of the recommendation coming out of that is you need to start prepping to build either two additional prisons that can hold about 700, give or take, individuals, or look at preparing to build another 1,500-bed men's prison.
Wow. Okay. So, and the price tag that we were kind of hanging on to from before was a maximum cost of $825 million. That's a big price tag. Now you're saying within the next 10 years, we won't be facing that again.
They do estimate that their recommendations would cost anywhere from $1.9 to $2.1 billion. That would, again, be constructing the either second 1,500-bed or, you know, second and third 700-bed prisons.
Okay.
I don't read too much into that particular number, because again, the report from 2021, when it listed out its suggestions on constructing a new men's prison, it was around the 400 some million dollar price tag. And as we know, the that was just like a firm that kind of estimated how much a prison would cost. But then when, you know, construction contractors got involved, that's when we got the kind of $825 million price tag that gave a lot of people pause. So it's kind of, they're an architecture firm. And, you know, who knows what's going to happen with prices 10 years down the road. But that, I think that's kind of a timestamp of like what that would cost to do that all today.
But this brings up these big questions of what you refer to as the, you know, the landscape, the cost of incarceration, the sentencing landscape. Is it population growth too, though? Doesn't population growth also feed into the need for more prison beds?
Yes, but probably not at this particular rate. Again, when you take a look at what kind of comes out of every legislative session, you kind of get additional felony charges kind of put on the books. And so politically, it's very popular to be tough on crime, right? That plays pretty well in that building. It's easy to campaign on. And a lot of lawmakers feel that particular way. But that has a cost that comes with it. And one of the things that really stuck out to me in this report, and this was stuff that I was asking about during the legislative session, which was a couple years ago in 2023, state lawmakers passed Senate Bill 146, which was billed as the kind of truth in sentencing law. It basically says that for certain kind of violent crimes, when a judge gives you 10 years in prison or 15 years in prison, you're actually going to serve that full amount. There's no like good time for getting out early. And this report estimates that roughly half of the growth that I was talking about 600 to 800 inmates, would be attributed to the effects of extending those prison sentences. And so when you take a look at the way lawmakers voted on that particular bill, and then a couple years later turned around and were opposing this kind of prison project, one of the things that I was kind of asking about was, is there an incongruence in terms of extending prison sentences and then, you know, being concerned about the cost of building a particular prison? Now, there are a lot of other things swirling around this particular prison project, lack of public input, concern about the location in Lincoln County and the price tag, et cetera. But at the end of the day, you know, this kind of tough on crime mentality that some lawmakers recognize they'll have to pay for, they're kind of starting to see the receipts build up.
All right. And then there's this idea of rehabilitation and recidivism and whether or not a new prison with new programs and new safety would actually reduce that. And that is a question mark, or is that addressed in this report at all?
If it's not addressed in this report, there's a very interesting moment that is occurring right now within the state legislature, which is a willingness to look at the kind of charging landscape that is currently in place in state law. Yeah. You have the governor's Project Prison Reset, which is sort of taking a look at the needs of facilities and what is needed to kind of advance the state's correction system. But you also have a group of a legislative group that is taking a look at the state's charging landscape. And I think we got a little bit of a preview of maybe what those efforts might kind of look like in this past legislative session when lawmakers, after years of rejecting changes to the state's felony level ingestion charge, which South Dakota is the only state in the union that has felony possession by ingestion law on the books, they were finally able to tweak that to where the first two charges, ingestion charges within a decade, are a misdemeanor and you have to go to treatment. And then the third would be a felony. So there's a particular moment that we're in right now where lawmakers are more amenable to sort of changing these kind of, to looking closer at these felony level charges that kind of keep getting added to the books.
Any other surprises in the report for you or things that you anticipate we'll be talking about in the days ahead?
I think one of the interesting things that came about in this report is sort of how it takes a look at the role of the Jamison Annex and the Sioux Falls Minimum Center, which is next to the Hill. It recommends that the Jamison Annex be used as a facility for special needs inmates. And it also suggests expanding the Sioux Falls Minimum Center. So the space in downtown Sioux Falls or near downtown Sioux Falls will still be utilized But the minimum center and the annex will have its own kind of particular role in those spaces. And then the other sort of varying levels of classifications of inmates will be somewhere else. That also remains to be seen, because the task force really needs to figure that out in the next two meetings that they have.
All right. Next meeting, June 3rd in Pierre. Do I understand that correctly? All right. Mm-hmm. Lee Strubinger, thank you so much for the update. We appreciate your time.
You bet, Lori.
You can find Lee Strubinger's reporting online, sdpb.org/news. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Secretary of Homeland Security and former South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem returned to the state last week. She received an honorary degree from Dakota State University and served as their commencement speaker. The move by the university sparked protests in the city of Madison. John Hunter is publisher emeritus of the Madison Daily Leader, and he's a member of the South Dakota Newspaper Hall of Fame. Michael Card is professor emeritus of political science at the University of South Dakota. They join me in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls.
Noem was invited to be the commencement speaker when she was still governor. So this would have been sometime before January or whenever her resignation took place. So over the years, Governor Noem and the legislature and the Board of Regents and many others have been very supportive of Dakota State University's growth. Those who are in charge of those sorts of invitations thought that would be a good way to honor her. Since then, the world changed, and she resigned that position and became Secretary of Homeland Security, of which she implemented some policies of the new administration, some of them which were unpopular with people at Dakota State University. Among them was the deportation of students, international students, especially, at least allegedly, those who were perfectly qualified to be here. There was a high-profile case out in, I believe it was Mines, wasn't it, Mike?
School of Mines.
Certainly international students were concerned with this, and a big part of the student senate had his international students. There are a lot of international students at Dakota State. So some of them abstained from a vote for that. So the remaining ones were, I think it was less than a quorum taken on that. So those students ultimately were opposed by not passing something. Faculty also had concerns, I think, on behalf of their students. Some faculty, of course, are also international people. They've come from other countries and would be here in various states of citizenship and or visas and that sort of thing. So it was, I think, a little bit of an awkward position for Dakota State then, because having issued this invitation, and you don't rescind those typically.
Right.
And I think it was a recognition of the real support that Governor Noem had provided while she was governor. So on the day of the commencement, let's catch up to May 10th then. On the day of the commencement, there were people protesting lined up along Washington Avenue on both sides of the street, lots of signs, so forth, and fairly vocal, very peaceful, very honorable protest. That was most of the morning. I think they were there from about 8 o'clock to about 1 o'clock. The commencement took place late morning. So, and that those kind of protests, of course, make local media. So Madison Daily Leader, television stations, other media of different sorts.
Associated Press, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So, and then when it was over, it was over. I mean, I didn't see any residual kinds of things after that, no protests once it had taken place. And I think people were moving on.
Yeah. So this idea, as I was reading the Associated Press story, that people were speaking anonymously, Dr. Card, and they were concerned about being able to speak up because they were afraid of retaliation from the administration. The university administration, then also, you know, the federal government, they were concerned about things. This seems to me to always be a delicate balance in higher education, with people wanting to speak up, but then they're going to get jobs in the future, and they're also balancing their future. Are there any insights that you take from how this unfolded at Dakota State that you think particularly went well, like this is how it's supposed to happen? People, you know, there's a vote, the administration makes a decision, there's a protest, we move on, or areas that you think perhaps maybe need to be revisited?
Well, I don't know that those necessarily need to be revisited, although I would add to this that it's the Secretary of Homeland Security is also in a position to perhaps funnel more money to Dakota State University for security issues. There are also students who are likely to be afraid of speaking up for anything. They just don't want to speak up. They often come up to the front of the class after it's over and ask what would have been a great question to take off. But that's the sort of thing that happens. You know, it's the university president is a duty provided to them by their governing board in almost all institutions. There's usually a commencement committee that determines who are some good candidates. They may make a recommendation or list a slate of candidates to the executive officer, the president of the university, who then checks it out with the governing board and sees if it's okay. The idea of protests, that there is free speech as long as it's not threatening to an individual, that's America, that they didn't try to deliberately disrupt the commencement is not cancel culture. That seems to be avoided. It allowed people to speak their minds and to state their views and perspectives. Yeah. From what I've read and reported, I don't live in Madison, so I didn't get to see this, but it seems that it went about as well as it could go.
Yeah. And then, John, several days later, there is a series of arrests, 8 arrests at 2 different manufacturing facilities in Madison. I'm not finding anything that says those were related. Are you?
No, they are. I'm quite certain they are unrelated. I can't see how the other agencies besides ICE knew about this thing sometime in advance so that they could prepare for this possibility. So I don't think it would be related at all to that.
So tell me what that was like with the coverage locally about the ICE workforce. I'm going to try and think of what they're called. According to information or allegations received by ICE, they did a workforce enforcement action, in quotations.
I'm glad you remembered, because
I wrote it down. I was going to call it a raid, but it was not a raid, according to ICE. It was a worksite enforcement action, so we'll use their language.
Well, there were 2 Madison businesses that were involved in this, 3 persons from one and 5 from the other. They were taken by ICE because they were not documented properly.
Allegedly. Now,
thank you. Part of the trick is that the action actually is partly against the employer. Remember, employers have responsibility to make sure that the people they employ are, check all these boxes. And so I've done that as a small business owner, and everybody, you have to have everybody in there. Part of the trick is that businesses, and again, of all sizes, don't have the capacity to recognize forgeries or false documents. And I'm pretty certain that's what happens here. They are actually available on the internet. You can get false documents to do that. So it's very unfortunate that the businesses are caught in this situation where they asked for the right documents, they got the right documents, and they brought them forward. So but the people were taken. I think the businesses are in some senses saddened because these are your employees. You treat them well, and they have co-workers and friends and so on. You hired them for a reason. They're doing a job. So now you're missing 5 or 3 people from your operation. Yeah. So it's, on the other hand, you want people to obey the law, and we've set up laws, and so it is awkward for the businesses, I didn't know any of the persons involved. I would have no way of knowing their names or anything. So
we haven't heard any fallout in the community from the school or the family, friends, relatives, legal aspects of how they're being treated, or that's not like on the street.
No, that's
at
a great question.
At the local coffee shop. Yeah.
That's a great question, though. And I think there is some discussion of that. And again, you typically would have children in school and people working with, there are a lot of people in I would guess the top 50 sized towns in South Dakota would have someone working with people who speak other languages in some sort of English as a second language kind of programs. And there certainly is that in Madison. And so I would guess that they probably were working with some of the detainees and were and maybe had, you know, worked with their children in school and so forth. So I think there is a sense of losing a little something there. Now,
we don't know if they were parents.
We don't know.
Okay, just to be clear.
At least I don't.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm making the assumption that out of 8 people who were working at a manufacturing plant, there might have been children, but I do not know that. Yeah.
And there may be other people who are in that same position who weren't detained in this particular one. We know we know these 8 were taken. But so I think there it just feels like there's this little gap where we had some people and they're not here anymore. I don't know, but people want to obey the law. And they recognize there are rules set up for these kind of things. So I don't think anyone's saying this is, illegal to do this or whatever. Right. It just feels
to go through their court process, too. So we don't know how this resolves yet.
But, we don't.
But, but it has an impact on a community.
It does. Even a small number of people in a, among a population, I just think it's felt.
And you recently talked to the Madison Chief of Police, which you're going to write about in the future, and they were not part of this enforcement action, but they were listed among the cooperating agencies, but the city police don't necessarily enforce federal law.
I always appreciate the insight when you get to talk to a chief of police or a sheriff, the things that go on beyond what I normally know. And they were contacted by ICE earlier, as were other agencies. They were something they called perimeter control or something like this. So I think they're kind of on the outside in case something happens. But there's so much cooperation among agencies in all sorts of things now. And I became aware of some other ones. We have whether it's controversial or not, I think it's a good thing. We have installed in Madison, the first city in South Dakota to install these cameras that take a picture of license plates and then compare them to databases. There's lots of cameras around. They're not the first to do that, but that somehow is involved in this database matching. And so they can literally, if there's a car that's being pursued in another state, within 12 seconds or something like that of when that is taken, then we can be notified that this car is here. And so there are some, people, criminals or alleged criminals from other jurisdictions who come through Madison that we can be aware of, whether they stop in Madison or they're just on their way through. But what struck me, Lori, I think with that conversation is cooperation with multiple agencies. And you think too, Highway Patrol has jurisdiction in Madison, partly because state highways go through there. The Sheriff's Department covers all of Lake County. Madison Municipal Department covers within the city limits. But then you've got ICE and you've got, whatever else. So, and the communication, I think, has improved a lot among agencies, just in my opinion, at least in Madison it has. We have a new police facility now in Madison, which has a lot of improved capabilities, including things that you often don't think of, whether it's interview rooms, privacy interview rooms, either for victims or possible perpetrators, where you can interview in a comfortable setting. It would be recorded. You can use it. It's not depositions necessarily, but to try to get the facts. I was just very warmly impressed by the progress of both cooperation and technology in today's police work in Madison.
That's John Hunter, publisher emeritus of the Madison Daily Leader, alongside Dr. Michael Card, professor emeritus of political science at the University of South Dakota. You can find this conversation and more political analysis at our Dakota Political Junkies podcast. Search for SDPB's Dakota Political Junkies on your favorite podcasting platform. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Every year, the U.S. government spends far more than it takes in. The interest on American debt has become one of our top national expenditures. Well, it doesn't take an economics degree to understand that ongoing deficit and increasing debt will impact your credit rating. But how does the recent downgrading of the U.S. credit rating by Moody's intersect with trade deficits and tariffs? To understand that, a degree in macroeconomics comes in handy. Fortunately, Joe Santos is here with more in our ongoing crash course in economic literacy we call Monday Macro. Joe Santos directs the Ness School of Management and Economics at South Dakota State University, where he also leads the Dykehouse Program in Money, Banking, and Regulation. He stopped by SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. So something new is that Moody's has downgraded the U.S. debt AAA rating. What does that mean? Because it sure got a lot of headlines.
Yeah, so Moody's was the last of the big three investor services, the so-called rating agencies, to downgrade. It wasn't a dramatic downgrade, and it probably or certainly will not force funds, pension funds, and so on to reallocate. They can still buy treasury bills, notes, and bonds. Doesn't disqualify that debt. It's nothing that dramatic, but I think it points to a growing, I don't know if it's a concern at this point, but certainly an interest in the credibility of U.S. Treasury bills, notes, and bonds. And more broadly, the credibility of the U.S. dollar as a so-called reserve currency. And this is to say, you know, we issue the dollar. To us, it's just our money. But to the rest of the world, it's an asset, a financial asset into which the rest of the world can invest as a safe haven. And as you probably could surmise, that works to our advantage because that means you've got a planet saying, please give me your dollar.
Yeah.
And so when you have, for example, a trade deficit, this is all very intricately related. You have a trade deficit. It means that on balance, we hold goods and services from the rest of the world. So they must have something in return. Well, they have dollars. And they accept those dollars willingly. And they invest those dollars in treasury bills, notes, and bonds and other things. But in the very financial assets that Moody's downgraded on Friday.
I want to get to that symbiosis here in a minute, but what were some of the reasons that they cited as the problem with America right now?
Yeah.
I mean, we know Moody's,
right.
But what were some of the things that they put in their report that said, here's why we're making
this
decision?
Here's why. Yep. Yeah. So let me answer it with the negative first, not the trade deficit itself. And I say that because that's been getting a lot of press, rather the budget deficit. So this is the amount that the federal government spends in excess of what it takes in tax revenue. So if we are keeping track, that number for the fiscal year 2024 was $1.8 trillion with a T. So it was a rather large deficit. Indications are that those deficits, that deficit situation will continue into the future. So there's that. So it's the large deficit. It's the sense that this is a persistent feature of federal budgetary position. And then, of course, as you and I have talked about a lot, if you have deficits and they are persistent, then you are adding to the debt, which is just at a moment in time, as we say, how much water is sitting in the bathtub. And that's $37 trillion. So they pointed to the deficit. They pointed to the debt. They pointed to the, in their view, lack of sufficient fiscal discipline at the federal government level. For some time, by the way, they said that this was sort of a pattern across administrations, across Congresses, and so on, a pattern of not addressing the deficit in a serious way, and so allowing the debt to grow. And so deficit, debt, and the budgetary process itself all led Moody's to say, you know, I don't think this should be quite AAA. Again, what it was downgraded to was nothing too shabby, but the point is it was downgraded.
And political gridlock.
That's right, the process.
We're not looking at the fact that this problem is going to be solved anytime soon.
Anytime soon. And, you know, it is on some level, I don't want to say this is being a bit playful, but it's just arithmetic. And so either you've got to reduce spending or you've got to raise taxes. We know what the instruments are, and in their view, there's just no political sort of will to turn those dials.
To do either or probably both. Yeah.
That's right, in ways that would make this more manageable.
Okay, so let's talk about, so they're looking and saying the proposals that are underway are not necessarily going to steady this ship, which I want to circle back to later. So put a pin in that. But meanwhile, the foreign exchange value of the U.S. dollar is going down. And those two things are related. How?
Yeah. So at the same time this was happening, and, you know, to be very transparent about this, as we were thinking about this next topic, we didn't have the Moody's downgrade yet. What we were working on was the dollar value, the foreign exchange value of the dollar. And so it, you can measure it different ways, but if you measure it, say, against the euro, it in the first quarter of 2025 has basically gone down. And the currency value across currencies, one relative to another, is very volatile. Normally, you wouldn't make much of a fall in the value of the dollar, you know, one day to the next. But what was weird, and there's a picture on the blog of this, is that the reward for holding dollar-denominated debt, think, again, U.S. Treasury securities, for example, that reward didn't fall, but the value of the dollar did. So it seemed as if there was something else, economists would say, an exogenous force, something from the outside that was driving the reduction in the value of the dollar. And that's what got folks sort of talking about this notion that maybe it was that the credibility of the dollar as a global reserve currency was not as strong as it was even months ago. So again, this is all interrelated because if we have trade deficits driven in part by budget deficits, they're two separate things, but it's just empirically true that we have a large trade deficit because we spend in excess of what we take in. And one of the larger spenders in excess of what they take in is the federal government. So that drives this process to some extent. This all works, as you said, in a sort of symbiotic way because foreigners are willing to hold our financial assets and, most importantly, U.S. Treasury financial assets. So when that dollar fell in value, and it wasn't just day in the life sort of thing, well, yeah, our interest rates went down that day, so nobody wanted to invest in dollars that day. It wasn't that. It was, again, exogenous, autonomous. It was on its own. When that happened, amidst all of the other policy uncertainty, I should say, to be very honest, the markets began to fret a bit that maybe this notion that you can always rely on the dollar and dollar-denominated financial assets, and in particular those issued by the Treasury, that this was all a very risk-free affair, that that maybe wasn't the way investors were looking at this anymore. And then that was that sort of order of magnitude more scary than just, oh, Congress can't get a budget passed.
Sure. So I'm having a hard time understanding how the budget deficit contributes to the trade deficit.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. They are two separate things, and you could have trade deficits without having budget deficits. But in general, the reason you have a trade deficit is because the economy spends in excess of what it produces. So we spend more than the GDP we produce. And so, as I like to say sometimes, we eat our stuff, and then we eat some of someone else's stuff. And so to the extent that the government is participating in this, then we could say that the trade deficit is in part occurring because the government is spending in excess of what it takes in. So again, a trade deficit is a feature of the economy where it's spending essentially more than its own GDP. And one of the entities in the U.S. economy that does that to a very large extent happens to be the federal government. So in that way, they are one of the big dissavers that lead to this macroeconomic feature of dissaving we call a trade deficit. So
let me tell you how I'm thinking, and then you can tell me where I'm on the wrong path, because I think I'm on a different road, and you're going to help me get to the... When I think of government spending, I think of Social Security and Medicaid and the defense budget as being those big three, and of course the debt payments, or the interest payments are now that, you know, a fourth huge amount. That's not stuff.
That's right.
To me, that's not a car that I imported.
Yep.
So that's the road that I'm on. Help me
figure
out.
But what it is certainly not is an inflow into national saving. It takes from national saving because it spends in excess of what the government spends in excess of what it takes in.
Right.
Yeah, really good point. So what it does is it reduces national saving. And so we don't have the saving to support the spending in our economy because we have some, say, bad savers. And one of those really bad savers is the federal government, which dissaves, which takes from national saving instead of contributing to national saving in a way that would reduce the trade deficit.
So when I think of the trade deficit, I think of manufacturing being overseas, and we're not sending enough overseas. We're buying more than, am I misunderstanding?
That's right. So we are selling more of that as stuff.
That's right.
We're selling a bunch of stuff, and then we're buying a bunch of stuff from the rest of the world. And on net, we end up with more of their stuff, again, on net, than they ended up with ours. And so that's where this connection to financial flows comes in. Because, you know, imagine all the ships sort of leave all the ports, and now you're just looking at the two traders. Just think of us and the rest of the world. We have a whole bunch of stuff piled up on our dock that we unloaded from other people's ships. They don't have a bunch of stuff. What do they have? They have our dollars.
Okay.
And so, and what do you do with dollars? Well, you invest them in dollar-denominated assets. And again, and, all sort of just empirical realities. If it turns out that your government, for example, wants to have a safe haven financial asset, well, one place you could invest those dollars is in U.S. Treasury securities. So you can have some foreign reserves. These are great questions. They're not things we think about. So the United States government, by the way, doesn't hold foreign reserves. We issue the foreign reserve currency. Yeah. So you never hear us thinking about and worrying about, you know, do we have enough hard currency? We issue the hard currency. It's just not a thing. But for other countries, they wish to hold on to, again, other people's money, particularly if that money is a reserve asset as the dollar is. So they take those dollars they have, they invest them in our financial assets. And again, because we have this, we sometimes refer to it as an exorbitant privilege. We happen to have money that the world sees as a reserve currency.
Mm-hmm.
So they're happy to hold it.
But slightly less so now.
But slightly less so. Yeah. And so, you know, what happens?
Because we don't have our act together.
We don't,
now,
that's right.
I want to bring this in, is this idea is that America is really stable. We have a rule of law. We have a government that peacefully transfers power. Mm-hmm. We have a steady manufacturing and resources and a democracy. We're a good safe bet.
That's right. And that's a really important point.
And that's how
point.
We got there historically to the point where people want to.
Right, okay. Exactly. That it, nobody gets to, you know, there's no ceremonial vote on the reserve currency.
Okay.
It just sort of happens and everybody gravitates toward one money, and it happens to be the U.S. dollar. So that's right. Over decades, this has just been a revealed preference, as we say. We just observe what other countries are doing in terms of where they put their financial surpluses, and they put them in dollar-denominated debt. This is why a fall in the value of the dollar in the way that it fell when it did, and again, it, not that the rates fell, but it fell on its own sort of independently, was a concern. Because exactly what you said, it's not even so much say, well, the world's thinking the U.S. Treasury is going to default. Nobody's really thinking that. It goes back to what you said, what I call in the blog social infrastructure, rule of law, independent judiciary, independent agencies more generally, a very predictable kind of policy space where policy sort of evolves in a very rational, expected way. Those are the sorts of things, presumably, that are not held in quite as high regard when the dollar begins to fall from this grace of reserve currency status. So again, none of this has happened in a sort of Armageddon sort of way, but directionally, it seems that things are going in a way for the U.S. dollar at the moment that are not ideal. And some of this is because there has been some talking down of the value of the dollar. You know, this notion that some of the administration have voiced that this kind of reserve status means that everybody wants our money, so our money's very valuable, and so that sort of fuels imports. It's not a conventional view held among macroeconomists, but that kind of talk, sort of talking down our currency, can be quite effective in a bad way.
And the blunt instrument that we've talked about before of tariffs and the sort of wildness of it might be this percent, it might be 100%,
right,
it might be 30%, and the changing, that sends ripple effects of uncertainty.
It does. And again,
doesn't mean we don't have a trade deficit that needs to be addressed.
Exactly.
It tool and how it's being applied is making people nervous.
That's right. Because you're speaking about this trade deficit, you're speaking about it in very sort of negative, pejorative ways. If you're acting in ways that are fueling uncertainty, all of this, you know, it doesn't take much for someone who's observing this demonstration of frustration with the trade deficit to think, at what point is this a sort of a disregard for the high regard in which the dollar is held around the planet as well, right? At some point, they're going to sort of take a look at the equations and realize there's this mirror image between the trade deficit and all of the treasury securities that are held by the rest of the world. About $8.5 trillion right now of the debt is held by foreign investors, public or private. at what point does the administration's animosity and frustration with the trade deficit become frustration with the high regard with which the dollar is held? And not that in and of itself, but just that that means the dollar is valuable, and that means imports are relatively inexpensive and so on. To what extent is that sort of thought process is going to unfold in ways that, you know, could lead investors to question the primacy of the dollar?
So can foreign investors start dumping it?
That's, you know, right now I think what's happening is folks are sort of watching. That's the Armageddon outcome where suddenly that reserve currency status is...
So happy that my brain went to the Armageddon outcome.
Right, right. Now, I am not there. I should be very clear. I don't think it's an Armageddon scenario. So right now, if you look at foreign exchange...
Is that what we're afraid of?
Yeah, foreign exchange reserves. Yeah. The dollar makes up probably 60% of these positions that foreign governments have in other people's money. 60% of it is the U.S. dollar. There is no competitor anywhere close to this. So in that sense, the system at the moment is robust. But you and I are discussing this on the radio, right? That's a sign that this is a topic of conversation in ways that those who cherish the reserve currency status of the U.S. dollar, as I do, would prefer we weren't discussing right now.
Is a trade deficit bad? How big does the deficit have to be before it's bad?
Yeah, I mean, the trade deficit, ironically, is a reflection of domestic features of the economy, our production, our consumption, our saving, and to what extent we consume in excess of what we produce. And so there's the trade deficit. Again, if this is a symbiotic relationship, and that is to say the rest of the world is happy to have on net dollars while we have on net their stuff,
we got cheap goods,
right?
And so this is a global economy, and that makes a certain financial sense.
That's right.
Because it here would be more expensive.
Presumably it would, because that's why we made it there. Now, again, at the margins, there can be cheating. There could be, you know, gamesmanship of certain types, that goods that are dumped in, you know, into one economy from another, that is to say, sold for less than their cost of production just to gain market share. All of that, no doubt, happens at the margins. But generally speaking, the trade deficit is this feature that presents when consumption, essentially broadly defined as investment spending, machinery, equipment, government, everybody consuming, we eat more than we produce, we end up with a trade deficit. So is it bad? Macroeconomics is pretty sort of, you know, agnostic about this. It's just to say it works. It's very stable because we have a reserve currency status of the U.S. dollar. So we tend not to sort of look at it in normative terms as to whether it's bad or good. But we are very aware of the fact that it works because of this kind of symbiosis, which has a place. If the rest of the world needs a sort of a hard currency, you know, reserve financial asset, and we provide it, that's literally what we are providing
we are
in exchange
providing
for
something.
The goods and services. Yeah. Right. And so economists see this as mutually beneficial.
They have bought something from us, and it's our...
Right. In some sense, they have gained that reserve currency, which we have produced through this rich and robust social infrastructure, rule of law and independent judiciary and predictable policy and all the rest, right? That's sort of how we earn that.
At some point, they hold our debt. And that...
That's right. But they do hold our debt. But again, presumably they have something to gain. And it is that their money doesn't carry reserve currency status and ours does. So
it's all making sense.
It's a symbiosis to macroeconomists. Now, again, I keep going back to this. I understand there are jobs lost when there are industries that disappear because production goes elsewhere. That's, of course, happening. That churn is always happening, and it's never funny, and it's never optimal to the person it's happening to. But from a macroeconomic perspective, we are trying to figure out the best way to produce stuff. As I always like to say, trade is a production technology at the end of the day. We turn soybeans into BMWs. The outcome is presumably one that is mutually beneficial across the planet. And so economists tend not to take a really strong normative position on that trade deficit.
So for this administration, and I know you're not a political scientist, but when they say like a little bit of, I hear this president say again and again, a little bit of pain, mm-hmm. and we're going to get to a better deal on the other side,
yep.
and we're pushing up against like, okay, the pain is making people nervous mm-hmm. because there is a consequences yep. to that pain mm-hmm. that can last for a long time we don't want. What's a win for the administration then? What does restabilization look
right.
like, where we come through and we're like, yeah, that was worth it? How
right.
do I know when it was worth it?
I think it starts with sort of working assumptions. And I think the way you can sort of argue their position is to say, look, they must be operating from an initial working assumption that some of the outcomes, the trade flows, where it's produced and who buys it and so on, are a consequence of essentially market failures. There are labor markets that do not honor labor's effort appropriately, wages are inappropriately low, or whatever the case may be. And so the idea is we're going to use this tariff policy to right these imperfections in the market.
Okay.
And you know, no doubt there are such outcomes out there in specific industries and so on. But the approach they're taking is very broad and very blunt. And I think it sort of really tests our sense of reality to say, look, these failures are everywhere. And so the blunter the instrument, the better. It doesn't strike macroeconomists that you have market failures, exploitation, they're producing it for less and dumping it and so on,
yeah.
everywhere. So again, to do this at the margin, to say, look, here's an industry where we know intellectual property is not being observed or whatever the case
sure.
may be, go for it, attack it, right that market wrong. But to do it in such a blunt way strikes, I think, I don't want to speak for all macroeconomists, but strikes macroeconomists as probably a bit a road too far.
Now, this is in a normal climate. This is a warning sign. This is a bit of a reality mm-hmm. check. I'm not sure we live in a normal climate, but I do want to address the U.S. Treasury Secretary said Moody's is a, quote, lagging indicator, which brings us to the point of, what exactly are we measuring? Are we measuring stuff that was happening during the Biden administration? Is it an immediate response to Trump administration? That's a politicization mm-hmm. of this.
Yep.
But from your standpoint, from a macroeconomist standpoint, is this lagging data?
I certainly the past is part of what Moody's is looking at, to the extent that past behavior is a good predictor of future behavior. Mm-hmm. But I think the current budgetary process and sort of debating and so forth around what would be appropriate budgetary policy is also indicating much the same thing. I mean, I don't think right now, regardless of party, that there is a sizable, recognizable difference in the yeah. way the executive branch and legislative branch is going about budgetary policy, you know, distinctly yeah. different from the way prior administrations have. So in my view, what Moody's is doing is assessing kind of patterns of behavior that presumably it reasons are going to continue into the future. Were it not, then what you would be observing contemporaneously presumably would be an improvement in fiscal discipline.
Yeah.
And that would earn you a gold star, not have yeah. you lose your gold star. So I don't think they're looking back only and saying that was some really bad budgetary policy, not now, but then, because that to my mind would signal an improvement. It must be the case that they looked back, didn't quite like what they saw, and then looked at the here and now and said, I think this is much of the same, and there's no indication that it's going to get better.
You can find all our conversations and our ongoing crash course in economic literacy on our website, sdpb.org. That's our show for today. We hope that it served you. From all of us at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.